Hello everyone and welcome to Neurology Webinar Club. I'm delighted today to discuss with you the clinical approach, diagnosis and management of cerebrovascular accident, also known as stroke. We're going to discuss the following point: pathophysiology and the classification of the CVA. How do you diagnose them from an imaging point of view? What kind of causes and concurrent disease you should look for when diagnosing a dog or a cat with a CVA, and depending on what type of CVA you are dealing with, what kind of diagnostic tests you should run, and the treatment principle of cerebrovascular accident. There is still a lot of confusion in the veterinary literature about terminology. What do we call cerebrovascular disease? What do we call cerebrovascular accident or stroke? Cerebrovascular disease is defined as any pathological process affecting the cerebral blood vessel. Cerebrovascular accident, also known as stroke, is the clinical manifestation of cerebrovascular disease. In terms of what kind of disease process could affect the cerebral blood vessel, they are divided in two types of disease process. The first one is the occlusion of the cerebral blood vessel, which could occur as a result of a thrombus. And you got here an example of a beautiful thrombus forming in the middle cerebral artery, causing severe stenosis of the artery, with the lumen being tiny there when it should be the entire size of that. And in that dog, this thrombus was due to atherosclerosis, secondary to severe hypothyroidism. The other cause of vessel occlusion will be when the thrombus form in another vascular bed and then migrate to the cerebral to the brain, causing thromboembolism. The second pathological process that can affect the cerebral blood vessel is the rupture of the blood vessel. So cerebrovascular disease can be divided in two types: occlusion or vessel rupture. Cerebrovascular accident, also commonly known as stroke, is the clinical manifestation of cerebrovascular disease. And therefore, depending on what type of vascular disease we're dealing with, we're going to have two different clinical presentations. If you get occlusion of a cerebral blood vessel, then the clinical presentation will be the ischemic stroke. While with rupture of the blood vessel, the clinical presentation will be the hemorrhagic stroke. And from now on, I'm going to look at these two different types of cerebrovascular accidents separately: ischemic stroke and hemorrhagic stroke. Ischemic stroke is by far, in human but also in dog, the most common clinical manifestation of cerebrovascular disease. So symptomatic stroke in human, about two-thirds are ischemic, while one-third are hemorrhagic. While in dog, although it's far less common to have a stroke than it is in human, in my experience, probably three-quarters of the clinical stroke are ischemic and maybe one-quarter will be hemorrhagic. It's important to have a little bit of knowledge about pathophysiology to understand how we diagnose and the principle of imaging diagnosis of ischemic stroke. The brain, as you know, has limited storage capacity and rely on a permanent supply of oxygen and glucose to maintain ionic pump membrane. With a drop in blood, with a drop in blood perfusion, you got very quickly the storage capacity are exhausted, and the ionic pump, especially the sodium potassium membrane pump, will fail. As a result of that, you're going to have cytotoxic edema. And when we talk about imaging diagnosis of ischemic stroke, we're going to rely mostly on the presence of this cytotoxic edema to actually diagnose an ischemic stroke. Now, this cytotoxic edema will take place in all the cells in the brain, but all these cells that form the brain don't have the same vulnerability to ischemia. And the most vulnerable cells are the neuron, which would be the cell body of the neuron, which will be located in the gray matter of the brain. In order of less vulnerability after the neuron, we've got the oligodendrocyte, astrocyte, microglia, and the least vulnerable cells in the brain would be the fibrovascular element. So coming back again to imaging diagnosis, we're going to recognize an ischemic stroke and pick it up by the presence of cytotoxic edema, and this will be more marked in the gray matter of the brain. What is the ischemic penumbra versus the core? An ischemic process is a dynamic process, and with time, the damage done to the brain will obviously vary in terms of volume of the lesion. And there are two different lesions that take place. The core, which is the area of the brain that is irreversibly damaged, and the penumbra is the area of the brain that could potentially fall into the core, but is potentially still salvageable. And what determines the penumbra versus the core is the fall and the magnitude of the fall into cerebral blood flow. And you can see that if the cerebral blood flow and the region has a blood flow of less than 10 to 15 mL per 100 gram of brain tissue per minute, then you're going to have infarction, which forms the core. While if you are between 20 to 40 mL per 100 gram per minute, then you're going to have neuronal dysfunction, so not severe enough to cause infarction. But here, obviously, this fall in cerebral blood flow is too prolonged or get worse, then the area that was the penumbra will fall into the core. In terms of therapy, there is a principle in stroke management called the therapeutic time window. And this is the very short window of opportunity that you have to prevent this penumbra falling into the core, and where therapeutic intervention could be successful. In human, this therapeutic time window is ideally the first 2 hours, but depending on the way center manage stroke, this could extend to up to 4 hours. As we're going to see with the management of ischemic stroke, this therapeutic time window, but also the type of drug available in veterinary medicine, would make any intervention within that short time window very unrealistic. How do we classify ischemic stroke? They could be classified using a number of schemes. The first one is which region of the brain it involves. And we commonly talk about cerebellar infarct, or for example, midbrain infarct or thalamic infarct. The other way we also classified ischemic stroke, it depends on the vascular territory and the type of vessel involved. Regarding the type of vessel involved, we distinguish two different types of stroke. If a stroke is caused by an occlusion of one of the major arteries of the brain, that will result in a large volume stroke, and we refer in that case as a territorial infarct, as you can see here. Well, if the occlusion takes place in one of the penetrating small arteries in the brain, then that will result in a small infarct, also known as lacunar infarct. Why this is important? At least in human, we know that lacunar infarct are in a large majority of cases embolic in origin. And therefore, if you have a lacunar infarct, they will focus mostly on embolic disease, while territorial infarct could be either embolic or thrombotic in origin. In terms of vascular territory, each artery of the brain supply a fairly well-defined volume of brain and territory of brain in terms of area. And therefore, there is very limited collateral blood supply between regions of the brain. So we define ischemic stroke as, for example, middle cerebellar artery infarction or rostral cerebellar artery infarction. So we give them the name corresponding to the region, to the blood vessel that likely supply that region of the brain where we identify the lesion. Other way to classify ischemic stroke is whether or not there is secondary hemorrhage. And that divides ischemic stroke as pale infarct or hemorrhagic infarct, if there is secondary hemorrhage. Why there may be secondary hemorrhage It's when there is reperfusion, the afflux of blood could cause an hemorrhage within the infarcted zone. Why it is important, and you got an example here of a cerebellar infarct, which I'm showing you here, and at the center of that, you got an hemorrhagic lesion visible on this T2 star gradient echo. Why this is important? Because at least in human, one of the management of ischemic stroke is the use of thrombolytic therapy, if given within the therapeutic time window, and thrombolytic therapy will be totally contraindicated in the presence of an hemorrhagic infarct like this one, due to the high risk of hemorrhage. This is a representation using postmortem section of the brain of the different territory of the arteries of the brain. And you can see here in purple the rostral cerebral artery, which mostly supply the rostral part and the medial part of the cerebrum, continue here in the medial part, while the pink part on the side is the territory of the middle cerebral artery, which is mostly the lateral part of the cerebrum. At the back in yellow, you got the territory of the caudal cerebral artery. In green are all the thalamic artery, and we will come back to that. They are different type. And then you got mo a number of brainstem artery that will supply the brainstem. While the cerebellum has two main artery, the rostral cerebral artery in gray, and in orange, the caudal cerebral artery. And it's very important to have that in mind, because when we're going to discuss diagnosis of ischemic stroke with MRI, we rely on the lesion being confined to one of the specific artery or arterial territory. This is a number of publications that we've done on ischemic stroke. The first one was one that I published over 10 years ago on the clinical and topographic magnetic resonance characteristic of brain infarct in 40 dogs. The one below, I was part of a multicenter study that looked at the clinical sign and the topographic magnetic resonance imaging characteristic of suspected thalamic infarct. There are very few studies in the veterinary literature about stroke, and the main reason is that they are far less common than it is in human. But I will invite you to read this study to get more detail about vascular topographic syndrome of ischemic stroke. What is the clinical characteristic of an ischemic stroke? You may be very familiar with this graph. On the right, you got all the letter, the mnemonic that we use to remind ourselves of all the disease processes that can affect the nervous system. V for vascular, I for inflammatory, infectious, T for traumatic, and etc. Well, we use that because all these disease processes that can affect the brain have a typical onset and a typical progression. Stroke are vascular disease, and therefore, typically, they will have a periacute onset of sign in the background of normality, followed by a slow resolution of sign unless there is permanent damage. And this is one of the characteristics that we're going to use clinically to suspect if a given dog or cat could have a cerebrovascular accident and more specifically a stroke. It is the temporal profile, especially the fact that the signs are periacute or acute with no deterioration with time, that raise the suspicion and should invite you to put vascular disease in your differential diagnosis. What do we call transient ischemic attack or TIA? Transient ischemic attack or TIA, also known maybe wrongly as mini stroke, refer to neurological sign that refer to a specific region of the brain, for example, left forebrain or right cerebellum, that resolve within 24 hours. And the fact that they resolve make them likely to fit the criteria of a transient ischemic attack. And the transient ischemic attack is caused by a temporary fall in blood supply that doesn't result in an infarction. And the sign will, for this reason, resolve within 24 hours. So there is no permanent brain damage. TIA cannot be diagnosed with MRI and even less with CT. So the diagnosis is usually made on clinical ground based on the fact that you got focal brain sign that resolved within 24 hours and a negative MRI or CT. In human, it's an important thing to take into consideration because it's a warning sign. And if you have a TIA, you got 1 in 10 chance of developing a stroke within 4 weeks. When humans suffer suspected TIA, most of them will have embolic disease as the cause for this TIA, and therefore they will be taken very seriously and further tests will be conducted to look for possible source of embolic disease to prevent this stroke happening. And when it happens, it's often at least 1 in 10 in the next 4 weeks. How do we diagnose ischemic stroke? CT scan, first of all, which is readily available in most emergency room in human and is fairly quick and cheap, is the first step if you presented with focal brain signs. Because the advantage of that, it can be done very quickly and help you to rule out mimic of stroke. And the one that human physicians particularly want to rule out quickly is the presence of intracranial bleed. Because if you have a bleed, you may need, for example, decompressive surgery, which will be performed very quickly due to the raise in intracranial pressure. However, with CT scan, it's very rare to see changes of ischemic stroke. And most of the time, the diagnosis will be made by exclusion of the other mimic. Conventional MRI is the way to diagnose ischemic stroke. And on this picture, you can see at the top a CT scan of a human where you can barely see any changes. While in the bottom picture is the same patient having an MRI scan, and you may have picked up already some changes within this area of the brain, which correspond to the area of the middle cerebral artery. Changes on MRI are usually seen within 12 to 24 hours, but you can maybe see earlier than that. And they are mostly related to the presence of cytotoxic edema. We'll come back to that in a sec. Other way to diagnose ischemic stroke and is using functional MRI. And functional MRI help in human at least to diagnose ischemic changes relating to ischemic stroke much quicker than you will do with MRI, with conventional MRI. And that could have dramatic implications with regard to maximizing this therapeutic time window. So these are MRI picture of dog with ischemic stroke, transverse section T2 on this one, and you can see changes which are fairly well delineated and correspond to the territory of the middle cerebral artery. Again, if you look, you can see that the changes are mostly in the gray matter. So you've got a lesion fairly well demarcated in a specific vascular territory, mostly affecting the gray matter, but also some white matter edema causing mass effect, and all that as is the hallmark of an ischemic stroke lesion. Here you got a dorsal view T2 wet scan where you can see again a lesion in the cerebral cortex and vermis and paravermis. This lesion is very well demarcated and it corresponds to the territory of the rostral cerebellar artery. Whereas this lesion there is affecting the caudate nucleus and the internal capsule, correspond on this T2 flare to an infarct within the territory of the striat artery, which is the branch of the middle cerebral artery. Other characteristic to recognize an ischemic stroke outside of the vascular territory is the sharp demarcation. And this sharp demarcation, as you can see it on the cerebellar infarct or here on the caudal cerebellar infarct, relate to the fact that there is very little overlap between vascular territory. And therefore, the lesion is, in most of the cases, extremely sharp in demarcation. The other characteristic of an ischemic stroke is that they will cause hyperintensity on flare here and T2. This is the same dog, again with a striat artery infarction affecting the caudate nucleus as well as the internal capsule. And this is due to the fact that T2 and flare hyperintensity relate to the presence of cytotoxic and to a lesser degree vasogenic edema, which characterize the pathophysiology of ischemic stroke. And as we've already mentioned, the lesion is more marked in the gray matter due to the fact that the very selected vulnerability to ischemia affecting predominantly the cell body of the neurons. In terms of contrast enhancement, you should not expect any contrast enhancement in an ischemic lesion unless the onset is more than a week. And you got an example here of a cerebellar infarct, T2 flare, and T1 post contrast when you start to see some enhancement. But in the acute phase, you usually do not see enhancement in an ischemic stroke. As I mentioned to you, there are a number of other MRI application in stroke in human, and to some degree, we started to scratch the surface in veterinary medicine is the use of diffusion and perfusion study and MRI angiography. The first two, diffusion and perfusion, had the advantage to recognize ischemic stroke much earlier than conventional MRI. An example here on the dog, where we done diffusion weighted imaging. So they are much more sensitive to toxedema, and the use of MRI angiography can help you to recognize the presence of a vascular occlusion. But the issue with MRI angiography is that it's mostly sensitive for the large vessel. For small vessel, it's too difficult to be able to image them with MRI angiography. What are the causes of ischemic stroke? Well, until recently, I would say until at least 10 years ago, most of the report of ischemic stroke done in veterinary medicine were mostly based on histologically confirmed case, which come down to case that underwent post-mortem study. And as you probably realize, that artificially select either case where the stroke was very severe, prompting to euthanasia, or where there was a sinister underlying cause. And therefore, what we knew until 10 years ago was a skew view about causes of ischemic stroke because we artificially selected the worst case. With the advance of MRI and getting more confident to diagnose them on MRI, we've managed to collect a larger number of cases that were presumptive cases of ischemic stroke. And that opened a totally different picture on associated conditions seen with ischemic stroke in dog and cat. So what we knew until about 10 years ago were quite severe or sinister underlying cause for ischemic stroke, septic thromboemboli, atherosclerosis secondary to hypothyroidism, migrating parasite or parasitic emboli, or metastatic emboli. This is a study I published 11 years ago on result of diagnostic investigation and long-term outcome of 33 dogs with presumptive diagnosis of ischemic stroke. And as you can see from this slide, we only find an associated condition in just over half of the case, which means that despite extensive investigation, which were blood work, blood pressure, chest X-ray, abdominal ultrasound, we only see associated condition in about 18 of them, and in 15, we didn't find any associated medical condition. When you look at the type of associated medical condition encountered at the time of diagnosis of ischemic stroke, quite a large number had chronic kidney disease and Cushing. And as we're going to see in a minute, some of them were also hypertensive as a result of these two conditions. In terms of, we look also at the presence of hypertension, which is commonly seen in human with ischemic stroke, and with the criteria that we use, which are, a mean systolic of 160 and/or mean diastolic of 110, we only identified high blood pressure in 8 of 28 cases that were looked at. In these 8 cases, we find a suspected underlying cause in 7 of them, and in 4 out of the 7, there was chronic kidney disease as a suspected cause for the ischemic stroke, for the high blood pressure. So far less common to have hypertension in dog compared to human, where it's a very common finding. Now we're 10 years down the line, and you can see that on this slide, we now have, and I've done that about 2 years ago, 62 cases of presumptive ischemic stroke. And still, we've got about half of them where we don't find an underlying cause, and in just above half, there is an associated medical condition identified. The majority of them chronic kidney disease and hypertension in four of them, Cushing in seven and hypertension in four. But we have a rise in number of protein-losing enteropathy and also hypothyroidism. With protein-losing enteropathy, the possible pathophysiological link is the loss of antithrombin, which could make this dog hypercoagulable. But again, it remain only, a suspicion there. What about cat? There is far less report of ischemic stroke, and in my experience, far less common in human that it is in cat than it is in dog. And in terms of underlying cause, it's more common to find, an associated medical condition than it is in dog. When an underlying condition was identified, it will usually relate to cuterebral or heartworm migration, cardiovascular disease, hyperthyroidism, or a neoplasia somewhere, or a liver disease. So what to take out of that? If you have a cat with an infarct, you have to look even harder for a suspected underlying cause, because it's more likely you got one than with dog, for example. So if you have a dog with an ischemic stroke, either confirmed or suspected, then this is the kind of condition I'm going to look for. Heart disease, hypertension, endocrine disease, chronic kidney disease, and protein-losing enteropathy. In terms of diagnostic test, this is the battery of tests that I will look to investigate this possibility. Moving on to now hemorrhagic stroke before we talk about treatment. As we say, hemorrhagic stroke are the clinical manifestation of rupture of a blood vessel. And if the blood vessel rupture in the subarachnoid space, the consequence will be a subarachnoid hemorrhage. If it rupture within the parenchyma, that will cause intraparenchymal brain hemorrhage. Subarachnoid hemorrhage is extremely common cause of hemorrhagic stroke in human, and it's usually secondary to rupture of aneurysm. This is exceptional in dog, and I've personally never encountered one, but it's a very common cause of intracranial bleed in human. In dog, when there is hemorrhage, whether or not it's subarachnoid or intraparenchymal, it's usually secondary to another disease. Vascular malformation may be less likely, but more commonly neoplasia, which could be primary brain tumor bleeding or metastasis of highly vascularized tumor like hemangiosarcoma. Vasculitis, coagulopathy, and common cause would be antivitamin K, but also Angiochongylus vasorum, at least in endemic region of the world where it is present, and hemorrhagic following infarction. Hypertension in dog is rare as a cause of hemorrhagic stroke, but it may be a bit more common in cats. In cat, hypertension is will be a common cause of intracranial hemorrhage, while other less likely cause would be intracranial tumor, but with secondary bleed, cerebral amyloid angiopathy, FIP, and coagulopathy. As hemorrhage is much more common in cat as a cause of brain hemorrhage, remember always on this case that you see with acute onset of brain signs to check the fundus, because you may be able to see some telltale sign of hypertension. Like on the top of this image, you can see an example of retinal bleed, while at the bottom, an example of retinal detachment. And that should prompt you to check the blood pressure on this cat. How do we diagnose hemorrhagic stroke? In that case, CT scan will be very sensitive to diagnose hemorrhagic stroke. And on the right, you can see the presence of an intracranial hemorrhage within the parenchyma that will show as hyperdensity due to the globin portion of the hemoglobin. That was usually seen very acutely, and with time the bleed will become isodense. So that's why CT scan in human is used as a first line imaging modality, because it's available in most emergency room, it's fairly quick to obtain, and is extremely sensitive to detect brain hemorrhage. In MRI, the situation can be a little bit more difficult, because the MRI signal intensity of a bleed will vary depending on the state of oxidation of the hemoglobin. So as you go, the hemoglobin will become oxidized, becoming methemoglobin, then deoxyhemoglobin, and so on with time. And all this byproduct of hemoglobin will have different MRI signal intensity. So the one of the most sensitive and probably specific MRI sequence to diagnose hemorrhage on MRI is T2 star gradient echo. And in that case, with a T2 star, an hemorrhage will appear as hypointense. They are over tissue that could be hypointense on T2 star, but in the context of a dog or a cat with a periacute onset of brain signs, then finding hypointensity on T2 star will be highly suspicious of a brain hemorrhage. Otherwise, if you use the other MRI sequences, you need to refer to a number of tables that you find in most textbooks on neuroimaging that will tell you, depending on the time from the onset, what will be the signal intensity of the different byproduct of the state of oxidation of the hemoglobin. This is an example of a gradient echo to show you how well you can show an hemorrhage. That's a gradient echo T2 star, and you show hypointensity within the brain. Well, on T2, a weighted scan, you can see that there is a lesion, but it's, very difficult to know if we're dealing with an hemorrhage, and it could be, for example, over a pathological process, inflammatory or maybe neoplastic. Well, on T1, apart from the effacement of the sulci, it's very difficult to pick up, but there is a lesion there. So you see the usefulness of gradient echo. As I mentioned to you, it's very specific, but other tissue can have the same MRI characteristic, gas, mineralized, iron, fibrous tissue, and melanin. But again, in the context of a dog or a cat with acute or periacute onset, that will be fairly diagnostic. We recently published, I would say recently, but it was 4 years ago, a case series of 75 dogs with non-traumatic intracranial hemorrhage. And what we're trying to do is to see, depending on the size of the hemorrhage and the number of hemorrhagic lesions within the brain, can we find some idea about concurrent medical condition and long-term outcome. We divided the dog depending on the number of lesions and the size of the hemorrhagic lesion. And you can see that when the hemorrhagic lesion was less than 5 mm and multiple, and you got example here, you got one here, 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 and that was T2 and T2 on the right and flare on the left. The most common suspected cause was cerebellar microbleed. At least in human, we know that the most common underlying cause is amyloid angiopathy, and a few cases have been also reported at postmortem in dog with similar MRI finding. We had 12 dog out of the 75 with multiple petechial hemorrhage. And in terms of what kind of associated condition we identified, two of them have hyperadrenocorticism with hypertension, two of them are chronic kidney disease and hypertension, one of them hypothyroidism and hypertension, while seven out of the 12 didn't have any concurrent disease. So moral of the story, when you got lesion like that, check for hypertension and also these different kidney and endocrine disease. The outcome was good in 5 out of the 12 dog in the long term. Other category of dog in that study, we find dog that had a single lesion of more than 5 mm, as shown here, T2, flare, here, and that's T1 without contrast. 43 dog had a single hemorrhagic lesion in the brain, more than 5 mm. No concurrent disease was identified in 32. But when an underlying disease was identified, we have a high proportion of angiosensulus vasorum. The prognosis was good in 26 out of the 43, especially if there was angiosensulus vasorum that was obviously treated, or if no underlying disease was identified. Dog that had multiple lesions of more than 5 mm are shown here. We had 20 dogs that met this criteria. In that case, it's more common to find an associated condition than not. Five didn't have any concurrent disease, while 15 had. Again, high proportion had Angiosongylus, followed by the presence of a suspected a primary extracranial neoplasia with metastasis. Six out of 20 dogs had an excellent outcome, especially all dogs with Angiosongylus vasorum that were treated had a good outcome at the end. Here is an example of what an MRI looked like at T0, so at the time of diagnosis. And this is on T2, while on T1 without contrast, you can see that there is a marked hyperintensity, and that will be one sequence that could be useful, the T1, if you got hyperintensity without contrast, because that will suggest the presence of methemoglobin, which usually is seen within about 3 days of the onset of the hemorrhage. And what you see here is a repeat control scan at 6 months to see, the brain can improve a lot, and you can see that we went from this to that in the space of 6 months, only with supportive care. So, what kind of condition I'm going to look for in a case with hemorrhagic stroke? Looking for coagulopathy and obviously underlying cause, that could be anti-vitamin K. It could be so rodenticide. It could be as well lungworm would be one if it's endemic in where you practice. I'm going to look for metastatic disease, especially metastasis from hemangiosarcoma, and finally look for hypertension, and if identified, looking for possible underlying cause, as primary hypertension is very rare in dog. Similar with cat. So in terms of diagnostic workup, you can see the list of tests we'll do. We'll do routine blood, so hematology, biochemistry, the clotting time, PTA, PTT, BMBT as well, thoracic X-ray, abdominal ultrasound, and fecal analysis to look for Angiosongylus vasorum. I should add to that the use of a SNAP test to detect Angiosongylus vasorum. What are the treatment guidelines for stroke as a whole? Obviously, it's important to look for an underlying cause and treat it accordingly. Otherwise, most of the treatment is supportive, and the priority is to maintain cerebral blood flow and oxygenation to the brain. And if we go in a little bit more detail, for ischemic stroke, that is in theory what would be the treatment plan. The first volet in the treatment of ischemic stroke should focus on monitoring and correcting any basic physiological variable that come down to the ABC and blood pressure management, and we come back to that. Ideally, you want to give a drug that will prevent the phenomenon of secondary injury. So you want to inhibit the biochemical and metabolic cascade to prevent neuronal death. And the third treatment would be to restore the flow of the affected blood vessel, so by providing thrombolysis. Looking in more detail to these three treatment volets, in terms of monitoring and correction of basic physiological variable, we're very fortunate that most dogs with an ischemic stroke would be able to maintain their airway, unless the stroke is affecting the region of the brain that controls the breathing. And in that case, it will be the brainstem or the caudal brainstem. So airway is something to consider, but it's rarely a problem with our ischemic stroke patient. Breathing, as I say, need to be assessed. If you've got a lesion affecting the caudal brainstem, it may affect the respiratory drive. In terms of circulation, that will involve making sure that the animal is on fluid, because as a result of the stroke, he may not have the ability to drink, and you don't want the volume, his blood volume, to decrease as a result of not providing fluid to this patient. And checking the blood pressure. If the blood pressure is high, especially in cat, we use amlodipine as a first-line treatment. Otherwise, if you suspect high blood pressure secondary, for example, to kidney disease, you may want to use an ACE inhibitor. In terms of neuroprotection, the holy grail is to find neuroprotective agent. However, even if some molecule which are NMDA antagonist, calcium channel blocker, or sodium channel modulator work in vitro or in experimental in vivo cases, when put to the test, none of them have actually shown any beneficial effect or convincing effect. And therefore, there is still no ideal neuroprotective agent that has been found to provide neuroprotection. If you are tempted to give glucocorticoid, there is absolutely no rationale to use an ischemic stroke, and it can sometimes be more detrimental in this patient. In terms of the third volley of the treatment of ischemic stroke, thrombolytic therapy is rational, as there is an occlusion of the vessel. Providing thrombolytic therapy is the quickest way to restore the blood flow to the ischemic area of the brain. Now, in human, the only drug that is approved to do that is RTPA, tissue plasminogen activator. You need to be given within the therapeutic time window, ideally within the first 2 hours. The main risk of RTPA is the risk of symptomatic bleed, which can occur in 10 patients receiving RTPA. In dog, we will never see them and diagnose them so quickly, and therefore RTPA is not used. But you may want to use antithrombotic therapy in the long term to prevent further thrombus forming. And we routinely use, especially in case where we suspect there could be hypercoagulability syndrome. So, for example, protein losing enteropathy, protein nephropathy, Cushing. We use Fragmin to provide antithrombotic therapy. If we identified on further tests the presence of a thrombus, for example, in the heart, or in the descending aorta, then we put the dog on clopidogrel as an antiplatelet drug. What is the treatment of hemorrhagic stroke? Again, it's important to identify as soon as possible underlying cause. So if you find that there is anti-vitamin K, you need to give vitamin K to this patient. If you identify that the bleed is caused by Aspergillus, in addition to symptomatically treating the dog, you need as well to give treatment for Aspergillus, which means giving Panacure. And you may have to give as well fresh frozen plasma to correct the clotting deficiency. Otherwise, the symptomatic treatment of hemorrhagic stroke consists to address the rise in intracranial pressure that will be caused by the bleed. That starts with extracranial stabilization. The best way to maintain cerebral blood flow is to make sure that the patient is have normal volemia, normal blood pressure, normal ventilation, and normal oxygenation. And if identified, they need to be corrected. In terms of intracranial stabilization, the principle is to reduce cerebral edema, optimize cerebral blood volume, and eliminate a space-occupying lesion. The last treatment principle will mostly apply in dog and as well in human, in the case, like you can see on this slide, of a subdural hemorrhage that is causing severe mass effect. And on this patient, the quickest way to resolve the rise in intracranial pressure is to perform emergency craniectomy to remove this blood clot. In terms of prognosis, we are fortunate that in dog, most dog will recover from stroke. And I would say roughly two-thirds of them, at least with ischemic stroke, and we've seen the prognosis of hemorrhagic stroke previously. And they will do so mostly with supportive care and treatment of an underlying cause if one is identified and treatable. But you need to remember that although most dogs will recover, there is in general no quick fix, and it could take a few weeks before you see the full picture in terms of improvement. Looking at infarct, we've already discussed prognosis of hemorrhagic stroke when we stratified them depending on the size and number of lesions identified on MRI. When we look at that 10 years ago, one-third of dogs were euthanized, and when they were at a poor outcome resulting in euthanasia, seven of them had an associated medical condition and three lack of improvement. And that was what prompted to be euthanized, because the associated medical condition had a poor prognosis. Dog in general that didn't have an associated medical condition identified on ancillary diagnostic test had a better outcome than the one where you identify an underlying cause. Also, dogs where you identify an underlying cause were more likely to relapse than the dog where there was no identifiable underlying cause. We now finish with this presentation, and I hope that it's been useful and will help you to manage further cases you may have of stroke as a rule, but more specifically, ischemic and hemorrhagic stroke. Thank you very much for your attention. If you have any questions, please write them in the Q&A box and I'll be happy to answer them. So we have one question about the use of mannitol in hemorrhagic stroke. Could it be contraindicated? Well, unfortunately, this is a myth. Mannitol is actually a drug that is commonly used in human and also in dog for treatment of raised intracranial pressure when extracranial stabilization has failed to improve the patient and the patient carry on getting worse neurologically. Yes, in theory, mannitol could exacerbate could be drawing water in the compartment when there is a bleed, in theory, but the main effect of mannitol is to improve the cerebral blood flow. And this benefit far outweighs the theoretical risk of exacerbating the volume of the pathology in terms of blood and drawing interstitial fluid to that cavity that form within which the bleed form within. So if you have a dog with hemorrhagic stroke that doesn't respond to extracranial stabilization and carry on getting worse, then I will definitely not hesitate to give mannitol. The other option will be to address the raised intracranial pressure to use hypertonic saline. Other question is, what do you use if you got a cat with retinal hemorrhage presenting with neurological sign for which you suspect intracranial bleed? Well, if I've got increased blood pressure, so high blood pressure in that cat, the first line would be to use amlodipine. And that would be the quickest way to actually resolve the high the raise in blood pressure and to try to correct that. In a cat like that, I will not rush to do an MRI. I will try to see if the neurological sign improve following amlodipine therapy and repeat obviously the blood pressure to see if you got an effect. And if not, then I will only then consider to do an MRI. There is no further question. Thank you very much for your attention and I hope to see you again for the next neurology webinar. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Laurent for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.